All right. Well, welcome, everybody. To those of you that have read my bio before or have met me, you probably know I'm a professor of psychology at New Mexico State University. So I first got involved with PEAR when I was an undergraduate at Princeton University. So it was about early sophomore year when one of my friends came down to my room and said, "You know, Igor, there's all this stuff you keep talking about clairvoyance and ESP and all these things. There's actually a lab that studies it here at Princeton." And I really thought he was pulling my leg at that point. So I ventured over, expecting to not find anything, especially since the exact address was the basement of the EQUAD. And to those of you that are not familiar with EQUAD, that's the Engineering Quadrangle at Princeton University, sort of a conglomerate of buildings, one on top of the next, all connected in these large, long, sort of meaningless hallways. And so here I am walking down the hallway, wind up going down the stairs and finding a shop where I thought this lab would be, but I take a look at to the right and there's the PEAR lab and I walk in. And those of you that have been to the PEAR lab know the kind of site that it is. And those of you that have seen pictures and were in the last webinar probably got an idea. Very welcoming place. And walk over straight to Brenda Dunn, sat down and told her a few of the stories that have been really puzzling me about things that have gone on in my life. And she then proceeded to tell me some stories that were incredibly similar. And that's how we hit it off. And so this is how I got involved in PEAR. I was an intern there for 2.5 years, helped with a number of projects, including the frog robot, which is one of my personal favorites. So I've kept in touch, of course, through the PEAR tree and through going to SSE meetings and through personal connections I've made that are quite invaluable. And went on to grad school at Arizona State, where my advisor was someone that had met Brenda in the late 70s when the Mac and PEAR lab were starting up, Mike McBeth at Arizona State, who was a perception psychologist. And so we had a wonderful time under his tutelage, and here I am a few years later, assistant professor at New Mexico State. Studying a number of different things, including embodied cognition, video game play, but the main research that goes on in our lab is actually with interfaces for unmanned vehicles, robotically controlled, typically. And so what I'd like to talk to you about today is filters, direct perception, and the symbol grounding problem. And that's really a number of different topics brought together. Within my own personal experience, within a few other, you can say, esoteric areas, I suppose. It's not something people tend to think about every single day. The journey started for me, in 2002 at Princeton University. I signed up for a course, Psychology 523, Philosophy 523, which was just titled Problems in Philosophy with Dr. Mark Johnston, who's the head of the philosophy department there. And not knowing what the real nature of the course was about, I was just welcoming to see what modern things were going on in the field of philosophy, because it's typically considered, like many of the problems have been solved. Well, of course, that's not the case. And so this is what this course addressed. The main problem that this professor identified was the problem of really determining whether perception is direct or not. And that's really what one of the main topics of the filters essay is really dealing with. And so those of you that have read the chapter will see this the next few slides as a review. Those of you who have not gotten a chance to see it, I'll just basically summarize my filters essay over the next few slides, so you get an idea of where we're coming from in order to start this discussion. And so the problem of perception in psychology, or the question of perception at least, is one of whether it is direct or not. And so there have been various answers that have been posited. And of course, if you Google direct perception, you might get something to the effect of naive realism, which is, of course, one of the positions that Thomas Reed proposed. And so different folks have made valiant attempts at answering it, of course, many in philosophy, many in psychology. And one of the more interesting responses comes from kinesiology, from the work of a Russian scientist named Nikolai Bernstein. And so let's take a look at what some of these folks had to say, really, in order to really determine whether perception is direct or not. And so let me back up a slide, I guess. What do I mean by direct? Now, again, like I said, this is not typically a question most people ponder, but is your mind, directly in contact with the things in the outside world is really the question. And so, indeed, are you perceiving the response of your sensory system to the outside world, and then is your mind detecting the patterns in that signal, or are you indeed in contact with the actual real objects of your perception? So are your mental faculties operating on models of those objects or on the objects themselves, in a sense? And again, throughout most of Western philosophical and psychological history, the general answer is that perception is indeed not direct. And so, in fact, we are living in a kind of virtual reality, in a sense. Now, there, in philosophy, that's sort of been the accepted mantra amongst many. There have been some people that have really tried to challenge that assumption. And so I've mentioned Thomas Reed before, who really purported a sort of naive realism in a sense that our mental faculties are indeed in contact with things that we're perceiving, color, sight, sound, objects, actors, properties of the environment. John Locke pointed out a few potential pitfalls of this position, as in we're all aware that the world is not really how it seems many times. And so Locke really purported a kind of scientific realism, whereas first-order properties of objects of the environment, such things as color or loudness or timbre or even mass, are easily apperceived by the mental faculties. Things like weight or second-order properties, things that come with some sort of knowledge about the environment, certainly are then second-order. And what Locke said is that what he purported was really scientific realism, as in what is true is what can be, what is presented to our senses, and then what can be operated on with our senses and our mental faculties. Now, recent ponderings on this issue, some of you which you may be familiar with, is Frank Jackson's Mary. And Frank Jackson's an Aussie philosopher. I believe he's still alive. And he deals with a number of issues, but what he's very famous for is the example of Mary's room, which I have a little graphic of right there. And so to those of you that are unfamiliar with the story, Mary is brought up in a black and white room her entire life. Now, she is brought up to be a neuroscientist, and let's say Mary is particularly talented and becomes the smartest neuroscientist that has ever existed, right? So she knows absolutely everything about the brain, and her particular specialty is vision, right? So at this point, she knows everything about vision, everything there is to know about vision. And Frank Jackson example has Mary at some point, let's say she reaches some point in her life where she's mastered neuroscience. She walks out of this black and white room and sees a red apple sitting on the table. And so the question is, does Mary actually gain anything at that moment? And there are a number of different questions. Of course, the obvious answer to most is that, yes, she now has the experience of seeing red. And so, in fact, I believe Frank Jackson's original article is entitled Epiphenomenal Qualia, and it very much argues for the existence of things like qualia, things, experiences, and knowledge that could be gained by experiencing something, not just by knowing something. And that's what Mary's Room really illustrates. Now, when you get sort of deeper into the discussion of whether perception is really direct, and Frank Jackson would imply no, right? In some instances, yes, in others. Mark Johnston basically boiled it down to what is the object of hallucinatory versus veridical perception, right? That's a tough one in the morning. So are those objects equal or not? And he uses a great sort of philosophical example to illustrate what's going on or not. And so the question of whether the object of perception to someone that's hallucinating and someone that's seeing something real is an interesting one. If we actually give the object of perception and hallucination the same value as veridical perception, such as the hallucination of a tiger versus a real tiger being in the room right now, that results in a number of interesting problems. So if in fact our mind and reality, those objects were indeed the same, consequences for those being present are quite different. And so the example Johnston gives is, of a medical patient, and he's laying at a table, and he's got a neurosurgeon that's taking care of him, and this neurosurgeon has great control over what this person is experiencing. And so in the ceiling over this person's head is a light. Let's say it's a red light, just for the consistency with Frank Jackson. And so at some point, this neurosurgeon hooks up the brain of this patient and can make him hallucinate a red light in the exact same spot where there is actually a red light. And so he begins by turning on the red light and then slowly sort of turning up the hallucination such that the person is hallucinating a red light in the same place that there is a red light. Now, once we turn off the red light, is the person still perceiving reality, right? And the answer is certainly no. So indeed, an easy way to see that the objects of hallucinatory or veridical perception are indeed quite different. Now, of course, this is a basic argument that doesn't even take a look into the validity of hallucinations or perceiving things in other dimensions. So we'll just keep it in terms of straight Western philosophy. So Johnston really concludes in the end that since the object of perception, of veridical perception, is indeed not the same thing as the object of hallucinatory perception, then indeed perception must be direct because we're perceiving something in that act before modeling it or creating some sort of mental representation of it. And so he argues that indeed, like Locke believed, that first order qualities, particularly things like color and timbre and things that don't need to be modeled, particularly by the human mind or the animal mind, are perceived directly. So we are indeed not in contact with a virtual reality. We're indeed living a real reality. And clearly we may make mental representations based on these first order perceptions. Now, from the psychological perspective, generally, mainstream psychology says no, that we, in fact, do live in a virtual reality populated by models of the real world. If you've heard the term schema, this has been generally used since the 70s, in social psychology research and a bunch of other psychological research, then you're aware of the fact that, when we meet new people, when we encounter new situations, a lot of the time what we're doing is seeing how those situations fit into the schemas we already have. That's indeed true. However, it may not be the entire picture. And so there have been a few psychologists through the history of psychology, namely James Dewey, who was, I believe, the third president of the APA and wrote a great article in 1898 called The Reflex Art Concept in Psychology. And so the reflex art concept basically is the supposition that all of mentation begins with a process of sensation, which then moves into perception, which then moves into cognition and potentially into action. It's linear, it's going forward, and that assumption, even though it's been illustrated to be wrong with, modern techniques that measure brain waves and brain activity, it's still sort of the way people tend to think about how things work. And in fact, if you open the average Introduction to Psychology textbook, that's the way it's been generally presented to the novice learner. Now, do we recognize the fallacy in this? Because, in order to act, you need to perceive. In order to perceive, you need to act. And he was one of the few early psychologists that really pointed this out while the rest of mainstream psychology generally sort of kept chugging along. Some of you may be familiar with the work of J.J. Gibson. So James Gibson is considered to be the father of ecological psych. And ecological psych really expands on a lot of what Dewey and Thomas Reed and direct perception philosophers have talked about, and really makes it a formal system within the field of psychology. Now, it's still considered to be pretty radical. And so, in fact, ecological psych is not mainstream. However, many of the principles of ecological psych have made it into mainstream psychology, such as flow fields and a few other things. So let's take a look at what at least Gibson had to say on the question of whether perception is direct or not. And so some of the basic principles of his model really have to do with two books that he wrote. And so I highly recommend those books to folks. They're some of the best reading I've ever done. And particularly The Ecological Approach to Visual Perception. And there are a few research centers that are really doing this work at the moment, particularly Michael Turvey at University of Connecticut, with large research groups really looking at how much you can get out of being able to navigate the world without mental models. And those of you that have seen a Roomba, which is a device that's built by iRobot, and so they're based on the same principles that are espoused by Gibson. So they're Gibsonian navigational principles. And it's a person at MIT named Dr. Brooks. I forget his first name. I always screw it up. So I'm going to leave it out this time. That basically has taken these very basic navigational principles and has turned them into, you know, navigation principles that are good enough for navigating the real world. Three or four simple rules. Rodney Brooks, thank you. So let's take a look at some of the main principles of ecological psych. Now, ecological psychology, I will say to those folks that are really big fans of psychology, talks very little about what it's like to be human. What it does do is talk a lot about what it's like to be an animal navigating in the real world. So a lot of the things that we do know about it have to do with retinal flow fields. And so the basic principles are indeed that perception is immediate and direct. It's not constructed. It's primary, and that sensation is incidental. And you know, that's not necessarily a very meaningful statement until you take a look at the sort of evolutionary purpose of the brain. And there was a recent TED talk by a professor from Edinburgh who really pointed out that the purpose of the brain is for you to be able to move around, right? It's not to make plans. It's not to remember people's phone numbers. It really is in order to be able to move. There's some great examples from the animal kingdom. Particularly, there's a sea anemone, I guess, that is free floating, has a nervous system until it latches on to a piece of rock, and the first thing it does after that is digest its nervous system. So no need to move, no need for a brain. When you look at the sort of the greatest advancements in robotics, what's going on right now is that robotics and robots are fairly good at doing very repetitive actions, but when it comes to adjusting their stride, when it comes to adjusting their grip to novel situations, they're terrible. Look at the average four-year-old. They're pretty darn good. So while computers can solve extremely complicated financial equations and try to predict the stock market, they still can't play a game of chess by actually moving the pieces, right? I mean, Deep Blue might have beaten Kasparov and they went to a draw the second time, I believe. And third game, Kasparov won. But realistically, Deep Blue couldn't have picked up a pawn off of the playing board and actually put it in the right place. And so if indeed perception is primary and sensation incidental, that's in support of what's going on there. Because the brain didn't evolve to detect patterns of neurons firing as a result of sensation, right? It evolved to interpret the environment that's actually causing these sensations. And so in fact, rather than putting sensation at the beginning of the reflex arc like is typically done, sensation is seen as incidental. And you can see that as a very important point. Perception and action are two interdependent aspects of a single dynamic system. And so this stuff has been shown experimentally many, many times. One very great illustration of this is our studies that immobilize the eyeball. And so, in fact, if you use a physical device or an injected chemical to stabilize the eyeball and have it now move around, what happens is that your vision starts to gray out and goes to a total gray in a period of about 10 minutes. Because as it happens, you need microsaccades, which are tiny little shifts that your eyes are undergoing involuntarily in order to actually be able to see. So you need a constant change in perspective. So you need to act in order to perceive and perceive in order to act. And this sort of one hand washes the other relationship is espoused throughout ecological psych. It's been shown, like I said, in various paradigms. So that one of the first examples of this were the plummeting gannets study in the 70s. And these are birds that live off of the coast, I believe in Scotland and Wales, around the Great British Isles. And so the way they hunt is they generally hover several hundred feet above the water. When they see a fish, they basically plummet down at, you know, pretty terrifying speeds. And in order for them to not totally basically disintegrate on contact with the water, they have to be able to draw in their wings and enter the water in a streamlined manner and break the surface and basically not die and catch this fish. It's a very complicated thing to do, right? And these birds are traveling frequently upwards of 50 miles an hour, and they always get this procedure right. And so people are wondering how exactly was this happening. And so, as it turns out, what's going on is that the birds are using a mechanism that all of you use when you stop your car from, you know, rear-ending someone, and all, you know, what that birds use generally in landing on tree branches. It's the property of tau, which is basically retinal flow. So if you look at the graph down here at the bottom left corner of the slide, it describes a retinal flow pattern. Now those elements actually increase at a proportional time to contact with approaching any given point. So as long as there's some sort of texture or surface that you're approaching that has features, then your rate of approaching that surface is directly proportional to the expansion of that feature on your retina. So you're directly perceiving how long it's actually, or how quickly you're going to make contact with the surface. And so that's something that was puzzled about until the late 70s, because in order to actually do that accurately, you would need to know the distance and current rate of travel. Well, most people aren't aware of that as they're moving around or driving a car, but they're able to stop their car fairly well without hitting somebody. And so tau is indeed the parameter that we all utilize in order to achieve this. And it's something we perceive directly. We don't need to model it. We don't need to have mental computation involved. It's something that's essentially reflexive. And so just speaking about reflexive things, kinesiology provides us some excellent evidence to the fact that loss of perception is indeed also direct. And so what you'll see here is a slide illustrating someone swinging a hammer. And this is actually one of the first studies done by Nikolai Bernstein, who was a Russian kinesiologist. He was a contemporary to Pavlov. And that's actually one of the reasons his research was not publicized as much, because lots of what he had to say was not in line with Pavlovian theories. And you also see the end of his last name. Nikolai was Jewish, so not exactly very popular in Russia at the two centuries ago. And so Nikolai studied movement, particularly the development of expertise and the process of motor learning. And he actually coined the term biomechanics. He identified the degrees of freedom problem, and the best example of the degrees of freedom problem is illustrated with little kids playing t-ball. And I think most of us have seen various baseball players and how they swing the bat. They all have many different styles, many different preferences. But you go to a t-ball game and you see the little kids swing the bat, and the way they swing is very rigid. It's very stereotypical. They, in fact, all look the same. And so Bernstein was able to show that through motor learning, through the development of expertise, people are indeed solving the degrees of freedom problem by locking up certain degrees of freedom and learning how to control different segments of their body. Well, in the process of identifying these issues, he ran across a number of different findings about the human body that suggest that we perceive a number of things directly. For example, biting. the average amount of time it, in theory, it should take you to adjust bite pressure would be to send something, send it to your brain, send it back. It's on the order of between 100 to 200 milliseconds. Now, as it turns out, if you blindfold someone, give them something new to bite on, we're able to adjust our bite strength within 20 to 40 milliseconds. And this is very important because if we couldn't, we would break our teeth. And so that means that in the period of time of roughly 30 milliseconds, you're able to perceive how much strength you need to put into the strength of biting something. And so there are a number of very interesting things that he found in terms of the development of movements that really sort of puzzled anatomists at the time, because people were perceiving and executing within a period of 50 milliseconds, whereas the estimated amount of time that it should take for the signal to get to the brain and come back out is about 200. So rather than modeling a lot of phenomenon and acting upon those models, people were actually responding as if they were perceiving directly. And so, you know, amongst philosophy, psychology, and kinesiology, there's converging evidence, at least in my opinion, is to the fact that some perception is done directly. We don't need to model everything. And just from a purely computational perspective, if we did indeed model every aspect of the world, I think that would certainly preoccupy a lot of what we do. And, you know, in reality, what we do is move around and interact. And so what our brain is really designed for is not modeling. It's actually acting and reacting in the environment. All right. So this to me, you know, is informative, but lots of us have been familiar with states that alter our perception. So there's direct perception, but what about states induced by things like meditation, hallucinations, medicines? There are a number of different ways, depriving the body, overstimulating the body, sensory deprivation. In fact, probably many of the people in the audience are experts in ways to do this. And so fields like philosophy, psychology, and kinesiology typically treat deviations in perception as degradation, so either misperceptions or illusions and distortions. And in fact, J.J. Gibson was in fact himself not fond of any alterations of perception that could really be positive aside from learning, permanent learning that goes on. And all of us probably know that after a half hour of meditating, the world seems brighter and clearer. And so how do you explain things like that? And so I think this model of direct perception really offers a very interesting perspective on perceiving these things, because if you do indeed assume, like cognitive psychologists do, that you live within a world of your mental models, then any sort of alteration of perception can be seen as truly non-veridical, as a delusion, as a distortion. However, if you operate from a direct perception model, then the things that you're perceiving in some of these states could be indeed veridical, just not accessible to you in typical states. And I think cultures, and again, down at the bottom of the slide, I use the term Eastern and animist, but it's just for the lack of a better term. Many of these cultures have figured out ways to deviate from their typical performance in perceptual states, so perceive differently as a result of some sort of physical or mental practice or some sort of ritual that they go through that, in fact, indeed can result in shifts and enhancements of perception. These cultures, of course, also acknowledge that there are degradations that do occur. Now, we won't really argue the validity of these things, because I believe that most of you probably do believe in and how valid these experiences are. But I'll just throw up this quote by William James, where he says, "Our normal waking consciousness is a one but special type of consciousness. While it's all about it, parted from it by the filmiest of screens, there lie potential consciousnesses entirely different, forms of consciousness entirely different. We may go through life without suspecting their existence, but apply their requisite stimulus, and at the touch, they're all there in their completeness, definite types of mentality which probably somewhere have their field of application and adaptation. No account of this universe and its totality can be final, which leaves these other forms of consciousness quite disregarded." And of course, he goes on to say how to regard them is really the interesting question. And so I think that really speaks to me and speaks to a lot of folks in really examining these altered states as being valid spaces to try to figure out what exactly is going on in terms of perception. And so in the essay, I talk about particularly functional altered states of consciousness, because clearly many of them are indeed not. However, the ones that are typically purposefully achieved through ritual are indeed functional. And so they play various roles within these societies, and we can talk about these roles, but that's not actually today's topic. What does frequently happen is that they're amodal enhancement attention techniques. So somehow they are shifting the way people are attending to their environment, and whether that's external or internal. And one of the key reasons that people do subscribe to these states is that the information gained in these states is otherwise unavailable. So if we could get it some other way, we would, or you know, typically would at least try. With these altered states, it does make things available that are otherwise unavailable. So in my filters essay, and sorry, this just jumped ahead a few too many slides. Let me just go back to 12. In my filters essay, I propose a state space model that of our perceptual faculties, mental faculties. And state space models are basically engineering based models where you have a number of different discrete states that a system could be in, and a number of different transitions from one of those states. And typically there's probabilities involved, and anyone that has seen a Markov model knows what a state space model is like. And so the way I'm seeing shifts in perception happening are basically shifts in these stable state spaces. And of course, these various amodal attentional shifting strategies like meditation or the use of extreme exertion or sensory deprivation are indeed these potential transitions from state to state. Now, within these states, what I see is happening is basically an enhancement of certain frequencies and channels of information. So lots of us have, mentally conceptualized this process of perception, particularly tuning into things that are typically seen as extrasensory perception, as really tuning a knob on a radio. And so if that's indeed the case, if that's what's going on, that's how I think things are being accomplished, that we're becoming more sensitized either to different channels or different time sequences or different orders of information in these different states. Now, clearly, we don't have a great concept of what exactly is being amplified. We do have biological assays with a number of different psychoactive drugs, which will tell us which receptor types are being enhanced, but that really doesn't talk about the kind of information that is it's allowing our mind to tune into. So what I'm really seeing filters function as basically the filters that are imposed on these channels of information and patterns of information that we can perceive. And so those filters come hand in hand with the various state spaces that we could inhabit. And so potentially if I go out and, you know, spend 20 years meditating at a Shaolin temple, I'm now have now adjusted my filters such that I'm much more open to perceiving the environment than the average Joe. That's sort of the jumping off point, and I realize we got a little bit of a late start, so I've been talking about for 25 minutes, so I don't have too many slides left, and what they really do address is, where do we go from here? So most of us are very much aware of the fact that not all perception is direct, and so yes, potentially we can conceptualize how filters maybe operate on this initial step, or the perception of first order properties, but all of us know that we have mental representations. And when it gets down to the nitty-gritty, mental representations are indeed symbols. Symbols are signifiers or signs. And depending on your exposure to semiotics, you may see symbols and signs as different things. Now, of course, as soon as you posit that the content of the mind is indeed symbolic, you have to deal with the symbol grounding problem. Now, it's been talked about for you know, at least a couple of thousand years. It was most recently formulated in 1990 by Harnad. And it states, and I'm just going to read from my piece of paper right here. So how can the semantic interpretation of a formal symbol system be made intrinsic to the system rather than just parasitic on the meanings in our heads? How can the meanings of the meaningless symbol tokens manipulated solely on the basis of their arbitrary shapes be grounded in anything but other meaningless symbols? So indeed, how do the symbols of our mind come to acquire their meanings? And there's, of course, the trivial symbol grounding problem of real everyday symbols and letters and syllables and, you know, whole sentences, you know, how do they acquire their meanings, right? So we've got that symbol grounding problem. But we've got a deeper symbol grounding problem, as in, how does meaning actually get mapped onto these mental tokens? It's very easy to map meaning onto spoken tokens, right? Because we have very nice rules for how we can explain things. But in our mind, we're sort of figuring out the various rules that psychological patterns are undertaking. But what is indeed grounding the outside world in our mental representations? And what is then providing meaning to these abstract symbols? And of course, you could posit a very simple system, sort of like a lookup table, that we have a bunch of abstract symbols that are directed to a bunch of sensory experiences. But that is a steep mountain to climb and involves quite a bit of computation. And of course, there are a number of different psychological models that try to do this. But you know, generally, we fail to solve the signal grounding problem. We have decent solutions to maybe just the physical signal grounding problem, which I'll get to in a second, but not so much how we ground meaning in these abstract concepts. So one potential solution I see, which I hope you can all help me with, is embodied realism. And so in the past 20 years, there's been a recent trend in psychology called embodied or grounded cognition. And so it challenges cognitivism, which has been sort of the dominant paradigm since the 60s, and it puts a primacy on embodied experience. So rather than assuming that the content of our mind are a bunch of amodal abstract symbols that are fairly arbitrary, the supposition here is that the content of our mind is indeed sensory, it's modal, it's completely embodied. So that memories are really collections of sensory experiences that are multimodal, not so much extremely schematized, abstract versions of what goes on. There's a lot of evidence to support this, and of course it's climbing a large mountain. There's some great papers I could always point all of you to at the end of this if you're interested in embodied cognition. It's also something that could you guys can throw up a link to from Wikipedia right now. And so in terms of formulating how embodied cognition works, it relies on a concept which we'll look at in large detail in a few slides, called perceptual symbol systems. And so this is where I think we can really make some headway in the symbol grounding problem. Now, the perceptual symbol systems were suggested by Larry Barcelou in the late 90s. And he's made some headway in explaining those few of these phenomena. There's quite a bit of experimental evidence to show that you know, most of what goes on in our mind is in fact embodied. And a great example is as follows. Now, most people don't think that they need their tongue to understand when someone speaks, right? Now, as it turns out, there are a number of mirror neurons that are located throughout the brain that are activated when I do something or when I see someone else do something. So, for example, when I say the words, I really appreciate being here, versus I hear someone else say those same words, the same motor program is actually executed in the motor cortex of my mind. And so if I was to go ahead and use some sort of drug to numb your tongue and have you listen to speech, guess what? Your ability to understand that speech goes down significantly. If I actually take a TMS scanner and I disable your right hand, your dominant hand, which you learn to count on, so if I just blast your brain right about here with magnetic stimulation and I have you do math problems, guess what? You're a whole lot worse at doing math just when the part of your brain for moving your hand has actually been influenced. And so there are a number of these embodied effects dealing with memory, with language, with cognition that keep coming to bear. And so I really see embodied cognition as the next step after ecological psychology in terms of acknowledging the preeminence of experience in the world at defining what goes on in the mind. So what's really missing? Even though embodied cognition's been around for the better part of two decades, it hasn't really gained a lot of headway, especially with mainstream cognitive psychology. And so what I think is really missing is attention to semiotics, right? And so semiotics is the study of symbols and the study of meaning. And so when we look at what is the nature of a symbol, and if you just look it up in the dictionary, it says it's something that stands for or suggests something else by reason or relationship, association, convention, or accidental resemblance. Now, that's generally true. Symbols are signifiers. They stand for something. Sometimes they look like those things. Sometimes they don't. Three folks, and some of you maybe are probably familiar with Langer's book, and Henry Hunt and Benny Shannon have looked at the distinction between representational and presentational symbols. Now, most people will, not most people, some people will actually just say presentational symbols don't exist. They're just the things themselves. And so Langer identified artwork as presentational symbolism. So, whenever we painted a landscape, it referred to an actual landscape. Now, looking at presentational symbolism, your very simple example is street signs, right? Those are clearly very symbolic, but they generally, except for the big red stop, the yellow signs that indicate people crossing the street or curvature of the road or et cetera, are indeed perfect examples of presentational symbols. And so I think by introducing this distinction to embodied cognition and to the debate of the symbol grounding problem, we can actually make some headway in really figuring out what kind of grounding is going on, because the whole point of presentational symbols is that they are indeed experiences. There are these embodied experiences that we can have. So if you posit that the majority of the content of the mind are these presentational symbols on which mental faculties can operate, then you are actually providing a solution to the symbol grounding problem, because these symbols are immediately and inherently grounded in the experiences which they present. Now, clearly, through the process of representation, remediation, abstraction, we've gained the ability to be able to plan and do a number of very positive things and be able to relate concepts and talk about concepts in general terms. Now, we just talked about the sort of the phylogeny of symbols, and most likely in terms of ontological terms, symbols did come from the ability to abstract something and to represent it and to remediate it. Now, arbitrariness clearly worked its way into the system, but it's not a necessary aspect of the system. And indeed, many, many symbols are very, very presentational. So this gets us sort of to the end of my presentation here. But let's just talk about what symbol systems have to be like in order to actually achieve the things that arbitrary symbols are posited to be able to do psychologically. So symbols are not like pictures. They are indeed, mental symbols. They are sensory motor records, right? They're highly embodied, highly multimodal. And of course, they're not holistic, but schematized, right? So if we were just a walking collection of every single multimodal memory we've ever had, like certain savants are, it would be very difficult to function otherwise in the real world, as many savants find. So the actual systems and the symbols we create are schematized versions of the real world. Now, Barzilay goes on to further say that, in fact, they're not just the actual schematized recordings, they're also the simulations that you can perform with those recordings. So in fact, the way I really see filters is really a way of the possible simulations which we can perform with what we've got. So by looking at the physical symbol grounding problem, you know, the physical symbol grounding problem is actually solvable, right? And so if we can map the physical world to whatever, you know, activity patterns that exist in our mind in terms of simulating the real world, then essentially we've grounded those phenomena there. But that really leaves us with a somewhat deeper question, and a few philosophers have tried to answer this, is how is meaning grounded? How, you know, experience being grounded, first order properties being grounded, that's all very well and good. But how do we actually ground meaning in these perceptual symbols too? So while I think the embodied realism position is a really good answer to the physical grounding problem, as in how these things actually happen within the physical processes of the mind, how the external world is internalized, the problem of meaning is really something that gets at a deeper issue. And Brent Tallinnell, those of you that are familiar with his work, suggested that the answer may lie in intentionality, that in order for something to have meaning, there needs to have been an intentional act actually performed in order for the object or the concept or et cetera to acquire meaning. Because indeed, if signs are signifiers, those signifiers mean something. So in order for something to be truly symbolic, it needs to be meaningful. Now, it's somewhat an unsatisfactory answer at what the actual symbol grounding, to the symbol grounding problem. It's somewhat skating over the surface of the issue, which is what I think Wikipedia specifies. But it does open up the discussion to what actually meaning is, and whether information is true meaning, and exactly what role filters have on this side of the equation, particularly whether they're just filters of simulators that we can accomplish with our mind. Are they filters that impose our biases? There are a number of different questions that can really be asked based on this position. And so I think right now I'm going to open up the floor for questions. Anything that we don't get to and that you'd like to contact me on, contact me about, here's my email address. Being a psychologist and having the initials ID, I couldn't resist. So id@nmsu.edu. And again, thank you for your patience and your attention. I know I tend to ramble, but I think I made it within 40 minutes, which is just going at 10 minutes over. So please, let's go ahead and have a wonderful chat. Serge, yeah, I'm taking a look at that. So yes, indeed, the direct realist account does treat the objects of perception as the actual external objects, qualities and events. I think it's, you know, you might be getting to part two of your question, but in the meantime, I'll at least talk a bit more. It's a hard pill to swallow for a lot of people, because realistically, you know, we've had a number of instances where we see somebody, we think it's somebody, you know, it's not them. So what happened in that situation of perception? So let's see what else you say. So my position is that physical signal does not come into the mind. The signal cannot interact with the mind directly because the former is a physical nature while the latter is informational. Well, I think lots of people would have opinions on this, right? And if you actually look at the work at PAIR, you know, in theory, what we are doing with our minds when we're influencing random event generators is influencing a signal. So, you know, in my position, I think the stuff of the physical world and the stuff of the mental world is actually one and the same. Now, this gets, of course, into the mind-body problem, as in how does the stuff of the mental become the physical and vice versa? So how does my desire for a can of soda result in me getting up and actually going out and getting that? And I think the mind-body problem is one of those other key issues, along with things like the symbol grounding problem, as well as the question of epistemology, as in what indeed constitutes knowledge, are really the three things that we're getting at with this discussion. I've been able to frame it from the perspective of direct perception. But realistically, I think all these things are very much tied together, as in determining what is the nature of information and what is the nature of knowledge, and whether those two things are indeed the same thing. And so I think that's indeed an open question. So from the Astral Navigator, it's a great question. So it says, how does the causality and distance-defying nature of phenomenon play into the theory you presented? I think that's an excellent question. So I think starting with theory of direct perception, and particularly taking a look at a state-space model where we can be made sensitized to other channels and other forms of information, I think that's a model for anomalous information transfer phenomenon. So anything like basically remote viewing. I don't want to just start spewing jargon terms, but any sort of situation where you're perceiving information you're not typically privy to. Now within embodied cognition and the symbol grounding problem, the real interesting question is whether we're getting this information symbolically. And so, this is something I was hoping that we would touch on with a number of the folks here, is that when people do remote view, generally they are very symbolic impressions. So it seems like we're becoming sensitized to channels of symbolic information transfer, which is fascinating because it's not just purely it's not purely embodied, although many mediums will have the experience of actually feeling like the person that is, literally embodying them. And so I think many of these phenomena have to do with the way these symbols are grounded. And I think with communication with potential other consciousnesses out there, a lot of it has to do with whether our symbols are grounded in the same manner. And so the easy real life example of just misunderstanding somebody because you have different comprehensions of specific words, this is very true for immigrants. We'll find this a lot, is that we have a specific concept of one word where it's either slightly shifted or not quite on target with the translation, all the way down to potentially communicating with other life forms, other beings, things that I've frequently seen as directed communication to me, either in dreams or meditation, frequently came purely symbolically, and it was really a matter of untangling the meaning of those symbols, which wasn't necessarily easy. And so I think that means that it's not necessarily knowledge that we're getting some sort of symbolic transmission of information, and that meaning isn't necessarily always grounded as firmly as as I would hope, at least. So Zach says, tipping off some of what ICRL's research is about, if filters do operate upon reality in an organizational manner, then would we consider such a filter to be direct realization, or would it be rather be another category of direct? Would it rather be another category of direct realization? Still direct via verisimilitude with real, measurable, the consensual world, but different in that true direct because a filter is in blank. So I know that many things are presumed in the second part, including levels of interactivity, and the presumption is that filter concept is a correct representation of not indirect. Okay, so what I think you're asking or saying is indeed that you are conceptualizing a filter, or at least one level filter, as a direct realization. So rather than direct perception, it's filters are accomplishing something like knowledge-based filtering rather than perceptual-based filtering, which I think is definitely the possibility. And filters is a very, very large category of things. And when I actually sat down to write the essay for filters, it was difficult for me to get a grip on the number of meanings I really see filters having and the number of meanings they really have in modern lexicon and specialized jargon as well. So like I said in the talk so far, the first way I conceptualize filters is indeed sort of a way to either limit or enhance, right? So basically shift the perceptual faculties, whether that's the degree to which they perceive certain frequencies of information, which frequencies, so both scope and acuity of what they're perceiving. But secondly, I think you're right. Many filters are indeed providing some sort of direct realization mechanism, as in I talked and touched on simulators very briefly, but what mirror neurons allow us to do really is directly realize a lot of the things that we, you know, many people seem to think that we cognize. So for example, you know, when we see someone get hurt significantly, so we tend to wince, or, you know, it actually feels like we ourselves have gotten hurt. And that process has typically been ascribed to things like empathy, learned empathy. But in reality, you know, that process, while also learned, is also very much embodied. So the same mirror neurons that are active when you hurt yourself become active when you see someone else hurt themselves. And they're even more active when you see someone you care about hurt themselves. So the knowledge of the pain and the direct consequence of that incident is directly realized through the simulator that then simulates that and, of course, doesn't actually execute it, right? So when you see someone break their leg, you don't crumple down on the floor clutching it, but it certainly is, you know, very much, you know, directly perceived, A, and also directly realized by being simulated. And quite a bit of the work in embodied cognition actually points to the fact that, you know, the majority of the way we feel emotion has to do with mirror neurons kicking in and executing those same, I guess, either, I don't want to say motor programs, but in a sense, the same sort of brain activation patterns in our minds as the person that's actually getting, experiencing that particular emotion, whether that be happiness, disgust, et cetera, et cetera. And so it sort of adds the whole observation that you're going to feel like the people you surround yourself with and be like the people you surround yourself with. There's some really neat evidence, particularly looking at kids that are on the Asperger's spectrum, showing them that by, you know, this is basically a biofeedback technique, and we've identified a particular pattern of brain waves that produced by the activation of mirror neurons, and by using biofeedback, kids on the Asperger syndrome are actually learning to activate their mirror neuron systems in a better way and are actually becoming better able to perceive emotions in other people, better able to deal with other social situations, and basically better able to function in current society, which is, again, I think a matter of shifting around filters, because you know, the typical kid who's got Asperger's syndrome, or, you know, milder form of autism, one of the biggest issues for these children is the degree to which they can filter the information coming in. And so that's why kids with you know, more extreme autism will have sideways glances almost always as they're talking to you. They can't make direct eye contact, and they can't be in rooms that are highly stimulating. Again, it's an inability to filter a lot of the incoming information, which is causing this. And interestingly enough, by you know, further enhancing their simulation abilities, and so ability to empathize with other folks, then they're making strides in many of the other aspects of their disorder. All right, so Zach says, another aspect of my question is addressing the way in which a filter can affect the physical reality with the mental schema of the operators. So is this direct, indirect? Oh, great. Thank you. Thank you for clarifying that. So does it create another category within the systemic understanding of the filter effect mechanism? So this is a very interesting question. So are filters then bidirectional in a sense? And so can our filter actually produce impact in the physical system? Can you relate to concepts of source reality in filters essay? I'll try, Astral. And so just to go back to Zach's question really quickly, if we're indeed the co-creators of reality, which is my operational assumption at this point, then it would it would, I guess, make sense to me that indeed filters would directly realize something in physical reality as they're functioning. I mean, that's clearly a bit more directional than I had previously conceptualized them, either in my essay or in my talk. But potentially, you know, you can easily take the double slit interference experiment and talk about exactly what you're talking about here. So to those of you that are unfamiliar with the double slit interference experiment, it's a classic experiment in physics. If we've got two slits, one on top of the next, and we send a single photon towards those slits, what it winds up doing is traveling through both of them in superposition, and it makes a very nice interference pattern on the catching screen. And so clearly, I think if filters work the same way as I posit them, then it should be bidirectional. And indeed, the filters you have should be causing some sort of physiological changes, or physical changes, not physiological changes. The degree to which that's realized is of course a very interesting question, because even in my own personal experiences with micro PK, it's frequently very difficult to tune into the right frequency and to actually impact some sort of physical changes. But I'll think about that some more. That's a very good question, Zach. So let's see. If perception depends on motor faculty, numbing and tongue impairs recognition of speech, should we expect stronger PK in those with stronger ESP? You know, that's indeed also a very good question. If we tend to assume that motor faculty are indeed parallel to, you know, the kind of faculty that are involved in psychokinesis, perhaps those two things are related. I'm not sure how much of an embodied experience, you know, the entire thing is. You know, I myself am someone that has experienced PK infrequently and ESP probably a handful of times at most as far as instances. And, you know, the relationship between the two to me has never been necessarily clear. I know people like Dean Radin and a few other folks in the field have posited a relationship between things like clairvoyance and ESP and PK as being somewhat different phenomenon. I'm sort of the camp, like Charles Tart, I call it all psi, and treat it as nearly the same. But it is indeed something I'd like to think about some more and probably discuss with a few of you if we can actually get this conversation going in the future, so that you can participate and we can all sit around the circle. I will go back to a question from the Astral Navigator too, as in relating to the concept of the source of reality in the filters essay. And that's a great one too. I was hoping someone would actually bring that up. And so it seems to me the source of reality concept in many ways is quite parallel to a number that we've identified philosophically and psychologically at some point, right? So it's clearly a bit more developed and quite a bit more interesting than the Plato's ideals forms that existed out there. And indeed, in many ways, it accounts for there being a, you know, sort of unified source of information out there, which, you know, Jung has identified as potentially existing, and a few other folks have identified as potentially existing. I really see things like embodied cognition and ecological psychology bringing back a focus on the body as being a way to really gain information or really gain, you know, truths about reality. Now, of course, the source of reality posits various levels, things that are available to us and things that are not available to us. Now, to me, it's fairly easy to see that we can construct filters in a way to really sort of put the blinders on and live our lives within a very comfortable reality. I think that's generally what goes on in people's lives, is that people tend to get comfortable, and that's what happens. You know, that's generally what's sort of happened in the field of psychology, particularly, is that the models that have been used to describe what's going on in terms of the real world and whether the mental world is a good reflection of the real world are fairly limited. And what they have been stuck on is a very cognitivist sort of approach to doing it. Now, there's been a recent, in the last 10 years, we have a focus on things like CAT scans, fMRI technologies, neurophysiology, so a return back to the physical, but there's still, a whole big part missing from neuropsych. It's the body. People aren't really paying attention to the body as a way of gaining knowledge, gaining information. The body is a lot smarter than modern psychology gives it credit for. So what I think within the context of the symbol grounding problem and the current discussion is really the two perspectives that I presented really have a lot to do with actually opening up new channels of acceptable ways to gain information. And I think if we can open the eyes of at least medical practitioners, which is happening across the country because there are grants being given out for things like meditation and other forms of perceptual alteration and, sort of grounding oneself, not necessarily grounding symbols, that are having a very positive impact on, themselves and the surrounding community. All right, thank you, Minnelli. I'll definitely take a look at the decision augmentation theory. I'll take a look at that. So, affect theory, the filters idea you described sounds quite similar to this. Well, I'm familiar with a few different affect theories, Jeff, but maybe not particularly Sylvan Tompkins. I could always take a look at it. And so, most of the affect research that I do actually has to do with affective computing and how we can actually create positive tutoring experiences. So, I'm familiar with some affect theory, but not generally too familiar with emotional psychology. All right, so let's see. Astral Navigator says, cosmic consciousness type experience, oneness with the universe, could be unmediated by symbols, unfiltered direct apprehension of knowledge. Yes, absolutely. And so to those of us that have had the experience of, a true religious experience of oneness with the universe. I would say not from cognitive rationalization of that experience, but from purely being there, it didn't seem like the communication was symbolic or filtered or stimulated in any such way as I've defined today. It seemed like the most sort of direct form of empathy / direct realization that I've ever experienced. So, it's hard to say whether, hard for me to say whether the consciousnesses that I've communicated with in my meditations are indeed, how to say this, indeed real entities, right? And that's a very big debate. But in the true ineffable experiences in which I have trouble putting to words, have trouble even describing in any other media, they are indeed unsymbolic. And I think the ineffable aspect of those experiences points to the fact that there's a lack of symbolic nature to their structure. Other aspect to your statement there is the direct apprehension of knowledge. So, I wonder if everyone in the audience would even agree to what knowledge, one coherent definition of knowledge, because I think that's something that I wanted to touch on in this discussion is whether really knowledge is indeed information, whether knowledge is structured, whether knowledge is symbolic. If indeed, can you actually apprehend knowledge or information directly rather than modeling it one way or another and understanding it through things like linguistic schema and other mental schema that our psychology has blessed us with. Heal, great question. I don't believe that any direct perception account I've ever read has talked about a two-way informational flow. Now, some of these people did address action at a distance at some point as being part of psychology, right? It's about as, two ways it can get, as in, social interactions potentially, influencing the behavior of one animal through your behavior. But the presumption is definitely one way. Now, that said, if you look at Gibsonian psychology and ecological psychology proper, a lot of the principles talk about the actor and the environment being interrelated and codependent. So those of you that are interested in ecological psych will find that many of the principles that Gibson identifies are indeed quite in line with what you typically see in Buddhist practice, such as dependent co-arising and the impermanence of everything, and the only thing being permanent is change. Now, strangely, Gibson had no exposure to Buddhism or too many Eastern religions. This was all coming directly out of realization of how animals navigate within their environment. Lisa, so yeah, I think I covered Mihail's question. So if I haven't, just shoot me another message here. So Lisa says, over the past few years, I've connected very closely with meditation and clairvoyance, etc. Some through formal training, some by personal exploration. One of the key concepts that has been embraced by the spirit guides I interact with includes them searching through my thoughts. Fascinating. For appropriate language phrases by which to communicate quickly with me, most of the time it results in a fairly direct exchange of information. Sometimes, however, the initial results of an exchange have been quite humorous and a new phrase is selected. Very neat. And so that's, that exactly gets at the deeper question here, is communication going on through a series of symbols? And I think with me, with, my spirit guides as well, it's been highly symbolic as well, whereas, I wouldn't call it necessarily phrases, because I think mine communication is a little bit less coherent than yours. But it is indeed somewhat humorous in some initial exchanges, and indeed not always purely efficient. Now that is indeed quite different from that moment of pure ecstasy and oneness that Astral Navigator identified, because that to me is while both are certainly altered spaces, they really do hold a very different impact on my psyche and the rest of my meditation. One is, very much like the experience of seeing truth with a capital T, whereas others are communication. Not that I'm a big believer in truth with a capital T, but it's something that I certainly differentiate from some of the other things. And just to get back to Mihail's question really quickly, there aren't too many direct experiments of at least direct perception that really look at two-way influences. The only things I'm really familiar with typically deal with things like the triple jump, right? So most of us are aware of the triple jump. It's an Olympics event. The particular skill to do a triple jump is not one people could complete easily, and particularly not committing a foot foul on your jumps is, involves an adjustment of your gait at the very last minute, which is, less than 50 milliseconds. Yet triple jumpers do this pretty much perfectly almost every time and are able to achieve this regardless of, where they started, what's going on, how much of an adjustment needs to be made. And so with most direct perception kind of studies, what folks are really looking at is behavior changing in a way faster than is predicted by cognitive models of modeling something like distance or modeling your own stride and then reacting. And so one concept I didn't quite mention was the concept of heterarchical control systems. And so that's something that was posited by Gibson and something that's been sort of shown, but not quite as well as I'd hope experimentally, but basically that we can perform actions that seem to be cognitively heavy in terms of computationally heavy at the speed of our reflex. And so, like I said, biting pressure, triple jump, a number of different physical acts that we are able to accomplish, such as divers adjusting their rotation when they're doing a high dive, or gymnasts, or etc. All these really involve our bodies adjusting in mid-air or in extremely quick amount of time with not enough time to model these phenomena. So direct perception is going on. I just don't know how much it's actually applied to things that are non-motor. Karen says, do you see intentionality for one's life playing a part in the substance of filters? If it does, it would shape selection and dominance of filters for function. I think intentionality definitely shapes filters, especially if we conceptualize filters as these simulators that we're running in our mind, then if there are certainly some simulations with which our mind is more comfortable than others, right? Not too many of us are thinking about the worst possible thing that could happen, although that is a disorder that exists. And so if you even look at the kind of cognitive decision biases we have, we tend to not look for disconfirmatory evidence. There's a lot of a lot of rosy recollection about previous life experiences, a number of different things that color the way we want to see the world and the way we do see the world. And so I think intentionality plays a big role. You can back up off one step and just call it mindfulness first, and intentionality second. I think I mentioned Brentano's work very quickly on intentionality. And so he believes that, for anything to have meaning, there needs to be an intention behind it. So if indeed filters are impacting the way we see the world, very likely that's the product of the way we want to see the world. So they're intentional acts. We started with the fact that we need to act in order to perceive and perceive in order to act. Well, filters are really determining how we're perceiving the world and filtering out, potentially mental content and what we think about the world afterwards, then setting proper intention would certainly, in fact, play a large part in the way those filters are realized. I think that's, I think you're right, Zach. People are getting hungry. Thank you all so much. It's definitely a pleasure being able to talk about this to a kind and informed audience. I'll be in the audience for future seminars, so I'll be seeing you there, hopefully.